The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you very much. On this stapled handout that you have, where on page 4, towards the bottom of it, and you can see at the top that last week we polished off the question of the open universe. There wasn't, of course, an open universe according to the Greek philosophers. And Jerusalem, however, testing for what actually happened, Jerusalem is the home of the empirical method where you find out what actually happened, as distinct from the necessary truth that logic might give you. Well, that's all that we had last time, and what I didn't deal with then was what we move on to today, namely society, open society. This was a phrase that Popper took up from a preceding philosopher in his reaction against the truth by definition that he saw in Platonism. The word society is derived from Latin and not Greek, notice. Last week we were dealing with philosophy and history, two Greek terms for your intellectual method. There are two ways of going about things: philosophically, seeking absolute truth; experimentally, seeking truth by finding out what actually happens. That's history, or, as they call it now, science. What we're coming to today is the 17th century turning point. Everybody agrees, when I say everybody, the pundits on natural sciences agree, that what has turned the world around began in the 17th century. Guess what? That was the century when King James delivered the Bible in English. In America, they call it the King James Bible, and in our country, the Authorized Version. And of course, we don't read it now because it's been retranslated. But it's significant that the King James Version gave a breakthrough for Bible knowledge in the 17th century, and concurrently in that century, there was founded by the Crown in England the first great academic inquiry institution in modern times, the Royal Society. Notice the term society. The Royal Society is still the ultimate accolade for the scientist in our culture, even here. And society, this Latin word, not Greek, this is the point. We're under the grip now of Latin generalizations. What is society? In the 20th century, we were wrapped in the concept society. That was our great classicizing term. But guess what? It's gone out already in the 21st century. We've shifted our categorization from society to culture. Culture is the word now. We're doing culture next week. But today we're doing society. It's not the only generalization that arose in the 17th century. Also arose then religion and literature. I wonder about law. Law's a problem, actually. I'll come to that in a moment or two. But look at the bottom of page 4. The first name there, under the heading Open Society, is Plotinus. 1,000 years after the great Greek philosophers, well into the middle of the Roman rule of the Mediterranean, is Plotinus reinforcing the Platonic absolutism of truth. And before him was the ruler of the whole Mediterranean, the only person or the only time in all history when the Mediterranean was a single whole under government. And that's Marcus Aurelius. And those citations at the bottom of page 4 are from the one man who controlled everything in the Mediterranean. His name, Marcus Aurelius. Middle to late 2nd century AD. He detested the Christians. So did Plotinus, who followed him. Plotinus may even have learned the truths of the Bible, but turned against it. So here are the guardians of the old order. Just read them. If the intellectual capacity is common to us all, common to is logos, reason. Who is Marcus Aurelius talking to? He is a field commander on the great frontier to the north of the Mediterranean, the frontier against the Germans. He spent his life there. He's not talking to the soldiers. He's not talking to his peers. He is talking to himself. He wrote this book. He is a Roman commander, but he's writing this book in Greek. He's wrapped in the Greek thought world of Plato. And he's addressing himself, nobody else. We have his text in Greek. And that's why he says, the common reason, the logos. And then he says, if so, law. We didn't have law last week. I forgot about it. Nomos also is common. And if so, the universe, the cosmos, is, as it were, a state, a polis. So here's another unit, a unit within the universal fixed cosmos, the state. My nature is rational and civic. My city and country is Antoninus, as Antoninus is Rome. As a man, the world. So is it the state or is it the world? The things then that are of advantage to these communities, both polis, two cities, he says. One city is Rome, the other city, the world. Only those things are good for me. What about himself? He's addressing himself. He's lifted himself beyond himself to the state he rules, the whole Mediterranean, and to the world itself. This is Platonism with a vengeance. Finally, on page 4, all things, notice carefully, all things are mutually intertwined, and the tie is sacred, and scarcely anything is alien the one to the other. One ordered universe. Turn the page. Now Plotinus, in the subsequent generation, is writing this. The same strain of thought, that unquote at the top of page 5, the reason principle of the universe in perfect adaptation of law to custom. So he is interested in law. And is law only custom? It's made to thread in its in and out, and all coalesces by a kind of automatism. So the universe is now a kind of clockwork thing. And law is part of it, is it? Notice the next phrase. Intentions are not to be considered as the operative causes. Nobody causes anything to happen. Why not? Because it's all predetermined. And remember from last week, you don't have to worry about it, because you'll all come back again next time around and do the things the same. Because necessarily, if the universe is rational, they must be the same. This is the powerful doctrine which still lurks in our culture. We half believe it. That's why we've got these columns on the paper. But notice what is banned. Intention. You can't plan, intend, seek, anything like that. It's a matter, he says, of the inevitable relation of parts. The life of the cosmos does not look to the individual, but to the whole. Now, I was asked about the Sophists last time, and the Sophists were quasi-philosophers prior to the time of Socrates and Plato in the 5th century, 4th to 5th century BC, who took a more drastic approach to reality, including such important doctrines as it all depends who's watching. The truth of public behavior and law depends who's looking, they say. This relativizes knowledge to the individual. Aristotle, see the prosy paragraph in larger print beginning the 5th century BC. I'm saying there that Aristotle solved this problem of what our nature is with regard to the law by saying that it is our nature to live under law. That's a fine doctrine for Philip Street. So it's not somebody imposing this on us. We don't have to grieve over the law. That's our nature. We are law-abiding people, say the Sophists, particularly if we're watching each other, then we're very law-abiding. The Sophists seriously hold this. The correct position for the Sophists depends on the agreed pattern of behavior, and the agreement has to be sustained collectively in public. It's a sinister doctrine, as you can already see from the way I'm talking about it. We have to be a bit nervous about whether it's only when people are looking that it matters. But that's what the philosophers were for absolute truth. The Sophists were for relative and convenient application of the law. So here's this table that I've given on the page saying what happens down at the level of society, which is our framework now, not the universe, but the society. How does society work? A terrible thought crossed my mind last night as I was reflecting on this. I've left law off the table. And yet we were talking about law, weren't we, a moment ago? And that's what the critics in antiquity are talking about. The big choice is, in the 5th century BC, is it law or is it nature? They set them in opposites. Aristotle says they're the same thing. Law is natural. That's why the state is important. The state reflects the natural truth of law. This is a dangerous doctrine. We don't hold it today. That is what we rejected in the 20th century, that the state has the ultimate control of truth. It does not. Nobody accepts that now. So what's Phillip Street for? Is it all in Macquarie Street that things happen? What happens in Phillip Street? Where does Phillip Street go on my table? Which column? I'm not going to tell you until the end if you ask me. I've put Republic at the top. And what is set against Republic? The household. What is the household? It's, if you like, the common sense or natural way of people getting together and supporting each other. You don't have any choice, really. You're born into the household that generated you. And in the long course of human history, there has been this great tug of war, and there is today precisely this, the battle between state and family. We have it literally this very week in our own country. Will the state decide whether I will live or die? Will the state decide whether I can be born or not? This is the age-old tug of war that the Sophists confronted between law and, in our case, family. And as you know, if you were here last time, these words I've strung into columns are arbitrary. I just throw them down. It's only an accident that law isn't there. All sorts of other things could be there. But my second line, magistracy and ministry. Magistracy is the Roman doctrine of superiority, but it comes from the Latin word for more. If you have more, you're a magistrate. You had greater power than the lesser people. Who are the lesser people? They are the ministers of the crown indeed. What are ministers? They are the servants in the household. From the Latin word for less, the minister is less than the magistrate. This is crystal clear Latin language doctrine, and it applies in our culture profoundly. We greatly value the ideal of ministry in public life. People long to be a minister of the crown, not to be magistrates, to lord it over other people, though the crown delegates to them. The crown's magistracy is delegated to the minister. And they crave in politics, I understand, to become a minister of the crown, meaning its servant, because as a servant, they will nevertheless execute the crown's sovereignty. So these are big matters in daily life. Notice two or three steps down the table, leadership or service. People wail all the time, we haven't got enough leaders. Will not someone lead? There's a famous columnist, a failed leader of the Liberal Party, I remember, who was a colleague of mine once, who writes a column regularly every week saying what we need is leadership. He, having experienced loss of leadership, understands the point. And there is this craving. People, the public, can't stand politics because there's no leadership. Nobody's doing anything. We want a magistrate to tell us what to do, is the effect what they're saying. But the parliamentarians are rightly treating themselves as servants. They are servants of the crown, of course, and in a wider principle, servants of the state. Skip down to status and rank. What I mean by this is how to deal with the fact that we are actually in charge of each other in various ways. One is necessarily almost, or by nature, shall we say, in charge of one's children for a few weeks at any rate before they get wise to it. So I call that rank. If the formalities and natural development leads to positions of responsibility, being married is a rank with commitments which Jerusalem endorses. In other words, the experimental testing understanding of life, which is what Jerusalem has delivered to us, rather than logical, necessarily arrangements, this experimental life does include rank, in my view. Rank is endorsed, but it doesn't make you the master of the servants. Mutuality is perhaps the right thing, but above all, it's rank is the position in which you are tested, because Jerusalem tests for the reality of what life is. And what is status? No one gives you status, it's what you assume. If you recognize yourself as important because you know more than other people, or richer, or something like that, that's status. And you can go wherever you like and they'll open doors for you because they know that you've got a lot of money or are clever or whatever it is, or a great sportsman. Great sportsmen have tremendous status. And above all, great actors have status. I'm mesmerized by the fact that the ultimate source of truth on a daily basis in our media is if you're an actor, or better still, an actress, although you're not allowed to say it in the feminine now, it's all genderless. That a woman actor will be asked for her opinion on whatever the issue is, and we will solemnly listen to it. For some reason, pretending, a life of pretense, that's what acting is. But how does that qualify you for knowing the reality of everything? So, as you say, I'm against status. I enjoy status, of course, meaning I have it. Why on earth am I asked to pontificate here? It's a status thing. But status is a trap. Rank, anyway, you can follow it out on me. I'll stop waffling. Go down the table. What about role? This is the thing that everybody assigns to themselves or seeks for themselves, and we assign it to each other. Your role is to do this. I challenge that. That is part of the acting approach to life, as though life is a play. I know Shakespeare said it was. But it isn't really, is it? And yet the word role is now the defining word in our culture. And that people will say to me, you are a role model. I said, I reject it. I'm not pretending, I hope not. So what's the option under Jerusalem? The option is mission. And that's fascinating because just as of now, this year, this is what great businesses seek. They want to know what their mission is, not their role. They don't want to pretend. This is real hard money. What is my mission? What will I do with it? Mission is a very positive word in our culture. So mission is the option to role then. Reflect carefully on consensus versus diversity. I've not time, I think, to elaborate that. But above all, it comes down to the difference at the bottom. Are we following ethics or morality? I've never met anybody, and I myself find it very difficult to explain why we have two words for what appears to be one thing. And we couple them together. Haven't you gotten any ethics or morality, we can say. But they are separate. And there are numerous sentences in the English language where only one will do, only ethics or only morality. But why? And the philosophers have a clear answer. The contemporary reigning opinion in professional philosophy is there is ethics only, not morality. And this was a doctrine taught in the 19th century by the great, the crazed German philosopher Nietzsche. He detected the truth about it. Morality is a fraud, he said. It's a fraud imposed on us by the Jews. And he was enraged that the German people should have swallowed this insidious doctrine that morality, which holds you down and condemns you and tells you what you must do and so on, this is morality, must be rejected. And that is the origin of our current phobia, which is called postmodernism. The postmodernist position is the position of Nietzsche that there is no set standard of what you should do. Forget it. Just lead a good, neat, ethical life. Ethics are harmless. That's what Plotinus and Marcus Aurelius called the inextricable unity of custom. No one complains about ethics. It's awkward if you tripped up by an ethical principle, but basically it's a classic custom-based conformity in the community. And what then is it that Nietzsche blamed the Jews for and would blame us? It's when you're enraged, particularly by other people, and our culture is driven by the culture of enragement. The demonstrations that always occur, the two sides with their placards in Macquarie Street, enraged with each other and shouting at each other. Now, what are they up to? They are driven by their sense of moral obligation. Nobody has told them to do that. They are compelled inwardly by the belief that they must demand that other people, not only themselves, they're not applying it just to themselves, though they do, otherwise they're hypocrites, but they're applying it to everybody. Everybody must do what I judge to be required. But this is what began in the Garden of Eden, when the Lord put Adam under the obligation not to touch the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That is the origin of our moral conviction. And it's when you accept the moral conviction that you must not do something, and yet you do it. Are you going to stop
me? Mr. Judge, can we pause you there just for a moment? You did ask me to remind you to perhaps do a reading. Would you like to do that now, or after we've taken some questions?
I'll do it now. At the very bottom of page 5, you'll see the reference to the New Jerusalem in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, and I brought the text in a new translation so that you won't be familiar with it. This is the Good News Bible. And I'm reading what it says there, chapter 2 to the Epistle to the Ephesians, not starting at verse 11, but starting at verse 19. And it's a comment on the state, really, which is our topic, and on society. And here it goes. "So then," says Paul, "you Gentiles," i.e. not Jews, "are not foreigners or strangers any longer." In other words, there is a state for you. "You are now fellow citizens with God's people," the chosen people, "and members of the family of God." This is the household exalted over the citizenship of the state. "You too are built upon the foundation laid by the apostles and prophets, the cornerstone being Christ Jesus himself. And he is the one who holds the whole building together," that is the whole structure, the society. "He calls it, he binds it together and makes it grow into a sacred temple dedicated to the Lord. In union with him, you two are being built together with all the others into a place where God lives through his Spirit," the Garden of Eden, if you like.
The first question, Professor, is the sense of community being lost in our modern society on account of multiculturalism?
Yes. The thing I mentioned, which was, I thought, a bright thought, was that we've let go the 20th century ideal of society, and we've shifted it. We have shifted to culture. It's culture, culture, culture all the time now. And culture and society are radically different things. So as terms, they're all Latin words, of course. They don't mean what they used to mean in ancient Rome. They mean what the 17th century taught us to mean. And society is partnership. That's what it means. It comes from the Latin word for partners. So we can easily see that fits into the civil structure neatly. But culture is a biological metaphor. It's to do with growth and plants and things like that. So we have shifted, the emphasis has shifted from a partnership culture, where the key word was society, like we would say religion and society, and that kind of thing. And now it's culture, religion and culture. So we've shifted. And the 20th century did that. The 20th century was the great catastrophe of the nation state. That's what ruined the 20th century. The great totalitarian states, which we're now all against. And so we've moved away from partnership to a growth metaphor, culture. But who is growing it and what is it that's being grown? What was the question? Have I answered it? No. I've forgotten what the question was now.
The question was, is the sense of community being lost in our modern society on account of multiculturalism?
Yes, I think because it drives us to retreat into our culture, like Christians now are in effect being driven by the culture doctrine. Okay, they can have their culture, but have it alone and don't inflict it on us, they say. And this is what multicultural leads to. If culture is to be the crucial thing, then we're going to have a state of warring cultures. That doesn't seem to be a good outcome.
And we have another question on the nature of the state. What do you think is the basis for the Chinese Communist Party's belief that it decides what is true or not?
Well, they say that because, of course, they're really Confucianists. And they believe it in an essentially coherent national community anyway. The whole of Chinese traditional culture is absorbed with this very stable, a brilliant achievement in historical terms for thousands of years. The stability of Chinese culture has existed, and now an extraordinary thing has happened in the last 50 years. The Chinese government has, with leaps and bounds, absorbed the 17th century empirical revolution of England, of all places, and so China now leads.
So how has it done that, Professor? You say it's taken over the 17th century academy. How has it done that?
Well, amongst many other things, of course. The European missions, the gospel missions in China were a great trigger. when the Chinese Communist Party came to power in 1949, the first thing that happens was send all the missionaries back home. And that happened, and everybody despaired as to what would happen to China, the opposite of what the despairers thought has happened. The growth of the church in China proceeded alarmingly for the parties. The party has now, the Communist Party in China, has come to terms with the magnification of the churches in China. They are growing rapidly now, and they grew rapidly without the missionaries. And the analysis of this is not for me to attempt now, but it is a very important set of events. But go back to the question.
The question is, what do you think is the basis for the Chinese Communist Party's belief that it decides what is true or not? So it's going back to your question about the totalitarian
okay.
state.
Well, insofar as they say that, they are retreating back to the state-based doctrine of Aristotle. That is Aristotle's judgment. The state will tell you. And the state, by the way, created law in Greek thought. The very word law, nomos, we know, was forged out of colonization in the Greek world. When you had a new colony, you had to divide the land up into chunks, your allotments. And the word for that was nomos, dividing things up, dividing up the property of the new state into just like we have now. Everybody owns a small chunk of the Queen's land. Our country is owned by the Crown, but the Parliament chooses to divide it up into chunks for us.
And we're still paying off our chunks.
Yeah.
Can you please speak about consensus diversity and how it might relate to the rule of law? So that's the in the two columns, diversity and consensus. So please, can you speak about this division and how that might relate to the rule of law?
A person called Friedman, a great guru of the business world, I understand, laid down this important dictum that the trouble with consensus is it's usually wrong. Now, it seems terrible to say that. I mean, and doesn't the Bible say you should all agree and be nice to each other? And of course it does. And you should love your enemies indeed. But there is a problem with consensus at the social level. And the whole huge movement of opening up the universe, for example, which we've had in our lifetime, has come at every point. Scientific discovery, i.e. historical finding out what happened, occurs by definition by breaking the consensus. It's not the accumulated wisdom of science is the truth. It's the breakthrough to a new point when you defy the consensus. So your individual calling, if you like, is to be balanced against your obligation to love your neighbour as yourself.
Thank you. Another question that you touched upon regarding the ethics and morality divide. Does this mean that the church should not be trying to influence the parliament in respect of abortion laws that are currently being debated?
I think abortion laws deal with a matter of morality, and I don't think, the Parliament is being asked to arbitrate on it, and indeed it has to do something, but it would be, I don't know how to word this, but there is a limit, surely. We cannot accept the Aristotelian doctrine that the state is the ultimate truth. Our 20th century rejected that. It's alarming, really, to see the state now choosing to determine who will live and who will die. That sounds too much like what we set behind us in the 20th century.
You said in your notes that it was when you were in your final year of university in 1945 when Karl Popper produced his work decrying Plato and the totalitarian governments that led to. Is that what you see is happening again now?
Yes, the whole desire in philosophical circles to get back to virtue, meaning not morality, not people getting angry with each other and saying you should do this, that's morality. They want to get us back to virtue of the Greek kind. where good behavior is defined and, of course, sustained by community agreement, but that means ethics only, or regulators. That is the road to defeat, in my view. Defeat for progress, amongst other things. Too much consensus.
We have another question here. Campbell QC recently pointed out in lectures on the history of equity that the law of equity was based on a causistic reasoning. We receive that term as a synonym for sophistry. Is there still a place for causistry?
Yes, I can see what they mean. Certainly, no one likes sophistry. And the reason why the word sophistry has a bad meaning for us is because Plato and his circle, and above all Socrates, denounced the sophists because they were wobbly in their judgment. And above all, things were relativized too much. The law was relativized by the sophists. I think I may have printed a comment on this in the answers from last week. I've forgotten. So what was the question again about sophistry?
It was Campbell QC's comment that the law of equity was based on causistic reasoning. Now, we receive that term, according to the questioner, as a synonym for sophistry. Is there still a place for causistry?
Yes, I don't, of course, know the judgment which is referred to. I'll have to take notice of this. I like to be able to answer, but I can't. I feel trapped by this problem.
Thank you. Next question. Intentions are not to be considered as the operative causes.
Yes.
Whether that is true or not, could you explain the use of the word intentions? Are they similar or different to our desires, our will, our thoughts? So intentions are not to be considered as the operative causes.
Yes.
Could you explain the use of the word intentions?
Yes,
please?
It catches all those other things that you've put down there, will, desire,
will,
all those things are articulated in our minds as things we mean to do or want to do, our intentions. And so the question is what?
Are they similar or different to our desires, our will, our thoughts?
They're facets of the same thing, which I'm calling intention. You can say intention is purpose, plan, etc., all those things. In other words, who's causing the world to go round? This is what it comes to. And in Jerusalem's column, your intentions are fundamental. They don't count in the Athens column.
Thank you. A question about Karl Popper. As a student of Karl Popper, what was the greatest thing you learned from him? And
okay. His last lecture, just before he packed his bags and went to Britain, where he became a great man, he had already written in Christchurch, New Zealand, where I was a student in 1944, he had written The Open Society and was waiting for it to appear in print. And his lectures were boring. I got detailed notes of them all, because we didn't have computers or anything. You had to write things down. I got my handwritten notes of everything he said, and I remember being electrified by the final lecture, where he more or less said, well, everything I've taught you is more or less irrelevant. He said that, and what he was referring to was the Aristotelian logical system. The syllabus required him to teach logic and ethics. That was the name of the unit, logic and ethics. So he took us through the logic of Aristotle and the ethics of Kant, the great German ethicist, and then he more or less said in the final lecture, now I'll tell you what really matters, and he gave me one word which has stuck. Falsification. That was Popper's great principle. How does science or history, he didn't know that science and history were the same, how does science find out anything? Well, not by accumulating evidence. He was particularly against Freud. What Freud did was just accumulate more and more examples of his theory. Well, you don't prove your theory by saying it keeps on happening, said Popper. The only scientific test is to see in reality, does it actually happen? And you seek not to accumulate apparent examples of it, but to look for the one false instance where it cannot be true. That's the principle of falsification. Only when that principle is applied can you rest upon the temporary security of a scientific conclusion. You need to think that out, but I believe that modern scientists collectively all subscribe to the Popperian doctrine of falsification being the key point. Namely, putting things to the test. That comes from Jerusalem. The Lord put Adam to the test in the garden. And all through the history of our culture, according to the scriptural or Jerusalem tradition, is one is put to the test. The psalmist put the Lord to the test. They say to him, come on, do better to the Lord. And our theologians don't grapple with this. The modern theological studies of biblical says there's no great book on testing in the Bible. They've forgotten all about it. It's there all the time. It's called temptation in our translations. But the essence of it is finding out by putting things to the test to see if it's true or not in practice. And it's a moral thing. That's why what is the truth of the Lord himself? Does he have truth? Yes, says the Bible. And the Hebrew concept of truth in God, in the person of God, is better translated trustworthiness. That's not me saying that. That's what the linguistic... I don't know Hebrew. But the Hebraic sense of truth is trustworthiness. A person whom you know through give and take. The prophets, they know the Lord. The psalmists, they know him. They see him, as it were, and yet they can't see him, of course, in the flesh. That's contrary to what they're saying. That they're seized by this give and take with a person they certainly know, who is putting them to the test, and they're testing him. This is the culture of Jerusalem. And it's given us a scientific world now.
Thank you. There's just time for one last question, I think. Can you please comment on the reaction against the course on Western civilization which is being proposed?
The what on Western civilization?
Can you please comment on the reaction against the course on Western civilization that was to be taught at Sydney University?
Oh, the unit. We call them units at Macquarie. A unit of study on Western civilization. Well, that is people closing their eyes to the real history and real science of the world as we now know it. They're trying to say it didn't come from the West. It came, of course, from China or Baghdad or somewhere like that, where they're more intelligent than us. No, it is simply untrue. And I dare to say that our equivalents in China or Baghdad or wherever, Mecca, know this perfectly. Certainly the Arabs know it. That the turning point in all of this was the 17th century discovery of the scientific method for finding things out. And it happened in the 17th century because of the impact of the Bible, the King James Bible. And what it did was to show you that the Book of Genesis, for example, is not a myth book. It's not just dramatic stories made up to make a point of principle. It does that, of course. We all treat Adam as a kind of point of principle. But it's not just that was the discovery they made in the 17th century. They decided to treat it as though, that's Athens talking to say, as though, but to try and treat it as what actually happened. In other words, the world did begin. And morality is implanted in us as the test of our humanity. So, I forget, this probably strays from the question.
The question was a comment on the reaction against the
Going back to this thing, it is obscurantism of the worst kind to say that one can't study it because it's called West. I understand there is a, if you like, a naive humility about it. Humility, of course, one should honour. it's to feel, well, we're not really as good as Chinese people anyway, is understandable, and I rather share that idea. But the historical judgment is that the West is irrelevant. We would have had this great modern explosive world if it had been left to the Chinese and Islam. Well, it wouldn't, and they know it. That's why the Chinese in particular have by leaps and bounds taken over and embedded in themselves the scientific and historic consequences of the 17th century reform. I may say that everybody in history and science accepts this, that what they don't accept is the explanation I'm giving, namely that it was, which I didn't invent, it was sown in my mind by a man called Peter Harrison of the University of Queensland, who is a great authority, more than I just draw it from him. He pinpointed the fact that what unlocked the world in the 17th century was treating the Bible as actually describing what happened and not just a pictorial account of our lives.
Well, thank you so much. Please join with me in thanking Professor Drake.
Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.